It is my great pleasure to introduce our today's distinguished lecturer, Bob Mankoff. Bob is a true pioneer of the internet. He led the design, invention, commercialization, standardization of the internet, which is a key technology connecting billions of computers and people together. For which he won the ACM Turing Award. Bob has founded 3Com and has a remarkable career spanning academia, research, entrepreneurship, and venture capital. So today, Bob will share his perspective on more than 5 decades of connectivity. We are truly honored to have Bob join us. Please join me in welcoming Bob.
In-law of the University of Wisconsin. In June of 1968, I married Amy Jill Blue, a cheerleader at the University of Wisconsin and a graduate of the class of 65. She is no longer with us, but here I am in Wisconsin. Dedicating my talk to her name. And incidentally, are there any questions? You should feel free to ask a question in return. Well, I'm getting more blank looks. Oh, there might be a question here. No, I am currently a professor at the University of Texas, and so I wouldn't be allowed to attend your football game. Saturday. Who are you playing on Saturday? And see, in Texas, you ask anybody and they know who you're playing. Todd was born in 1946. Dolly Parton died in 1946. And look at all the exciting stuff that happened in 1947. Television was wireless then. But the big thing that was invented in 1946 was the transistor. Do you all know that? Familiar with Moore's Law, the transistors are getting smaller and faster forever. And this is my great fortune of being born that year was I got to enjoy the years that followed it, based on the transistor. Any questions yet? You need a Chinese saying, whatever you can call it. This is my roads are connectivity. This is the Roman subway map of the Roman Empire. And you'll notice that the Romans thought that all roads led to Rome. And then there was this technology chart featuring my presumed ancestor, Black John Metcalf, whose secret weapon apparently was the header bundle, his technology for road development. And roads are connectivity also. But in the 60s, by the time the 1960s came, we had a telephone. And my mom would say, I have two moms, so when you get there, call. Let the phone ring 3 times and then hang up. I love my mother, but not that much. And by the way, you'll notice that the telephone didn't change much. This is the Model 500 in 1949. This is the Model 500 in 1984. This is what happens when you turn an industry over to a monopoly. It takes forever to do stuff like, for example, can you imagine Steve Jobs holding one of these up? Every year. Connectivity is the subject of this talk, but the so-called, what would you call him? Poet Shannon had theories about connectivity. But keep in mind, he only theorized mathematically about a very specific part of
here's a list of the other parts. We're all, those of us working in the connectivity field, we like to increase the speed, reduce the noise, and currently the hot topic is reduce the delay. Latency is the current hot topic in networking.
Nothing new.
Question again? So this is a picture of my personal computer in the fall of 1965. It's an IBM 1401. You punched cards over here on the right. In other words, you take your computer program and you punch them into a card. Then you take a bunch of cards in a deck, as the word deck originated, and you feed it into a card reader, and then the card reader reads it, and the processor, here's the processor over here, it processes the cards and then prints your error messages on that great big printer. And so the modus operandi is you work all day on your program, you take it to the comm center at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, drop it off, and then the next morning you come and pick up your printout, which generally was just...
Hey, Bob, I got a question.
Did
you ever meet Claude Shannon?
I never met Claude Shannon.
Oh. He was at MIT around the time that you worked around.
Yeah,
okay.
Thank you. So you got me. I never met Claude Shannon. His name has been... It's in comeback mode now. How many of you are Claude users? This is the Claude they're talking about, Claude Shannon. So this was the new wave of computers in the 60s. Interactive timeshare. And these are two PDB-10s, one over there, one over there. And this is the terminal. This was this is how you talk to a computer in those days. This is a teletype with paper. And so you would type into your program, and your program would give you answers a few seconds later. It was a huge improvement over the punch card. And this was the computer that ARPA decided to put on a network. It was to be a network of PDB-10s. So we started working on what ARPA, the funder, called resource sharing. So the original use of the internet was resource sharing. What they meant by that was they didn't have to buy a PDB-10 for every university. They wanted to be able to buy a few PDB-10s and then have everybody else network in through the resource sharing network. So networking dumb terminals was the original use of the internet circa 1970. And what I did, this is how I got involved. I built this device, which is stood between our PDB-10 and MIT, and this packet switch. The packet switch was like a refrigerator that took data packets and sent them around the world. So this is what the internet was like in 1973. And I like to think of it as this circuit that goes coast to coast ran at 50 kilobits per second. And I noticed the prefix kilo has dropped out of use. And so these are the yellow areas, or highlighted the two areas of this network where I put MIT, one of MIT's computers on this network, and then I moved to Xerox Palo Alto Research Center and put, the first job they gave me was to put Xerox on the internet. It was then called the ARPA Computer Network. So the,
can we ask a question?
Yes, please.
50 kilobits, is that because that was the limit of online, or why was that the rate of the limit?
The AT&T provided modems and the circuits, and this was the fastest you could economically go long distance.
Because, today the phone system will do like 56 kilobits, right, with the Carlos coding and all that stuff. But this was different circuitry than like what your mom was having.
Yes, different circuits.
Okay.
And the AT&T kept saying, you'll never get more than 14.4 bits per second through our telephone lines because of Shannon and what he had to say about channels. While they were saying that, there were startups selling 50 kilobit per second modems and more. And so as the internet was going faster and faster and faster, as you'll soon see, the terminals were getting smarter and smarter and smarter. Thank you for your question. This was the terminal when we started. It went from paper to glass, sort of midway, and finally, the first personal computer. And we could have a whole argument about whether it was the first personal computer, but not today. And this is what they built, what we built at the Xerox Productivity Research Center, and it's still, it's the source of my great luck. I was given the job of networking, which is the job of a set. Imagine that. One on every desk.
Who would want to do that?
We wanted to do that. So here's a picture of me before even. Just to give an idea, in the upper, this right-hand corner here is a Texas Instruments Cylon 700, 30 characters per second on paper with an RS-232 cable running at 300 per second. And that was top of the line internet terminal. Up there at the tippy top is a box of 35 millimeter slides. We didn't have PowerPoint, so we took slides with a camera and we developed them as you would a camera and put them in a carousel and showed them at presentations. This is a Rolodex. You don't see it. This is that telephone again. These are pencils. And that's my office in Palo Alto as I began typing the memo inventing Ethernet. And there's the documentation of the memo, which I wrote on May 22nd, 1973. This is a hand-done diagram from the memo. You'll notice that over here is the radio ether. So the ether was the name we gave to the medium through which packets were exchanged. And we called it the ether because we wanted it to be open to any medium. Eventually, we chose coaxial cable here, but we didn't want to call it coax net because that was too narrow. So we called it Ethernet. And we imagined there might be a radio version of it, hence radio ether. And this is where I invented Wi-Fi. And I say that just to annoy the people who actually invented Wi-Fi. Here it is, 1973, guys. I'm really sorry. There is Wi-Fi right there. And this is the notion of a router using a telephone circuit, to your question, to connect these two sites. And here are the shared coaxial cable. Imagine the coax down the center of the corridor. And if you wanted to be part of the network, you would pierce that cable and become connected to it. And this version of Ethernet, I'll call the Park version, introduced three technologies: Gerald Manchester and AlohaNet. Gerald was a system for puncturing the coaxial cable so that you could connect to it and send packets in and out. Manchester was the encoding that you used on the bits to clock the bits out onto the cable. And the Manchester encoding was the pattern of clock ticks. And finally, the Aloha network, which was a packet radio network at the University of Hawaii. I'd recommend visits there. And that was a joke. Oh, I don't know. I know. You don't know what a joke is. The Aloha network, I went out there. The radios were this big. So there was no chance of getting it into the PC. So we didn't choose radio. This is where we did choose to be Wi-Fi in 1973 because the radios were too big and it would take 25 years, it turned out, for those for the semiconductors to come along to make that possible. Okay, so Ethernet is being invented now in this story, and the personal computer is being built. So here's a picture of the personal computer. The Alto, it was called, from Palo Alto. And this would go under every desk. These under every desk. There's a removable disk cartridge, which held this disk cartridge right there. We called it the pizza oven. Could hold 2 megabytes of data. Where would you get that much data? And this is the
the first Ethernet card plugged into an option slot extender, and this represented one of the two major constraints. One constraint was we needed to have the network working by the end of 1973 or we would be killed. Because a bunch of other people were building the PC and they wanted a network when they were far enough along. The other constraint was this card. David Boggs and I, may he rest in peace, we debugged that Ethernet card. It could hold 60 chip dual inline packages at a much lower density than you all were used to. A single chip could hold 2 flip-flops, 6 inverters. It was, but we managed to squeeze it onto the card, and that's an important constraint. We had to get it done on time, and it had to fit on that card. And you would think that such a brilliant design would be an automatic slam dunk, but no. As soon as we showed Ethernet, we had competitors. My favorite competitor is Ethernet. He's ever built a network, you know about Ethernet. Prospective users say, I don't need a network. I'm going to put on my sneakers, put my document on a diskette, walk down the hall to the printer, put it in the printer and print. I don't need your network. I can just carry the diskette down the hall. But instead, we invented Command P, or sometimes called Control P. Print the document that's on my screen, and it would automatically go down the Ethernet to the printer. Anyway, another of the competitors to mention is Cygnet. It was a young grad student working on his network, Cygnet, when I arrived at Xerox PARC. His name was Charles Simony. He is Microsoft billionaire number 4. They asked him to stop working on the network. Of course, Metcalf is the network. So he went to go do Microsoft Word, and he's a billionaire, and I'm a pitiful billionaire. And he was convinced to stop work on Cygnet, which was basically a 50 megabit per second version of the ARPA network. Any questions? By the way, Ethernet won this competition, and I cheated. They gave me the job of building the operating system for the world's first laser printer, and using an Alto as the controller, and then this, you can see a picture of it there, this huge Xerox copier converted with lasers. So I made it so that the only way you could print a document on this printer was through Ethernet. That meant everybody who had a PC in the building needed one of my cards to plug in so they could be on the Ethernet so they could print their memos on this machine. I recommend cheating. If you're building a network and you want people to use it, you've got to give them a reason. Something that lures them onto it. So there it is. That's the Xerox Alto. You can't see the Ethernet because it goes out the back. But you can see the bitmap display. You can see the mouse. You can see the 2 megabyte removable disks, the disk, the pizza oven, and this is where the option cards were for the PC. So I left Xerox in early 1979, and question.
So on a prior slide, you had a photograph of something that will show my age, but I started it. Back in the 80s, and you had a PC-100 up there, and that's what I started working on. And DEC did a lot of networking work around about the time that you did. That was invented about 2 years after Ethernet, if I have my dates right. And then they did a lot of work to push the technology with their thick line and thin line of connectivity. And I'm wondering how you're going to talk about Freecom now, which was a competitor in those days in terms of networking technology?
No. I was a DEC guy. I programmed PDP-10s before this all happened. So there's no way that we would fight with DEC, which at the time was the second largest computer company in the world.
Yeah, then Boston. I left. That's when the whole company
all went down. There's a stone with your name on it out front. No, we partnered with DEC. So DEC Intel, a brand new semiconductor company, founded in 1968, and Xerox, formed a group called DIX, D-I-X, joined by my startup called 3Con, to promote Ethernet as a standard. And so that group produced an Ethernet spec and submitted it to the IEEE for standardization. And that decision to make Ethernet an open standard was all important in its success, because the customers wanted to be able to connect all their equipment together, and we were going to offer them an opportunity. So I left Xerox, not exactly, I lived in Silicon Valley, so when you're in Silicon Valley and you, for any reason at all, you go start a company. In fact, there's a lot of companies out here that start. It's great to see. So I started a company, but I didn't know what it was going to do. And then one day in June, as I was incorporating on June 4th, the phone rings and it's a guy named Steve from a city called Cupertino in a company called Apple. And he wanted to talk to me about being his networking guy. So, by the way, I never heard of any of these three, so it was just a hunch. So I went and had vegetarian food on Stevens Creek Boulevard in Cupertino with Steve. Steve. Word has reached Wisconsin about Steve. Anyway, Steve and I had lunch, and I went prepared to sell him something because I had a new company. He went as a recruiting. I flatter myself. I assume it was a recruiting. And he asked me about running the company, and I told him I had just founded my own company, and would he like to buy my first product? My first product was called Orchard. Get it? Steve didn't get it. As they continued down this recruiting path, I only sold him stuff later. He was very helpful to our company for all the 1980s. So he made me buy an Apple II. And he made me buy a copy of Hisicalc, the world's first spreadsheet. And so I did a business plan, and there it is. You can see the spreadsheet in the way to the top. And then in September of 1980, I took this plan and went out and raised venture capital. And this is what we got, the classic Silicon Valley triad, the entrepreneur, the investor, and the adult supervision. Adult supervision is a very important concept, and Steve Jobs knew about this too. A lot of people think that Steve was a great CEO. He founded Apple in 76. He became CEO in 96. Steve appointed a series of adult supervisions between 76 and 96 before finally becoming CEO himself. So I got some supervision. It made sense. I've just spent the previous 10 years as a researcher, and now I have a company and $1 million and rugs. We used to argue about whether the discount on the Coke machine should be 50 cents or a dollar. Should we give our employees the benefit of dollar Cokes or 50 cent Cokes? And apparently the idea of Cokes is caught on. So anyway, supervision, investor, this is the classic Silicon Valley triad. And then a wonderful thing happened. Here's a company whose purpose is to make Ethernet to connect personal computers, knowing that the world had no personal computers to speak of. And along comes IBM and introduces the IBM PC in August 1981. And 3Com, busy as a bee, beaver, managed to create an Ethernet card that would sort of plug into that PC and put it on an Ethernet. And we shipped that product in 1982, and we broke a rule. You're never supposed to take two startups and make them rely on each other, because the product of two numbers less than one is even further less than one. Well, here's four startups that we, Silicon Compilers, designed the chip, the first Ethernet chip. Seek fabbed it, another startup. My company put it into a system with software, and BusinessLand sold it through retail and only because all four of those startups showed up on time. Very unlikely. Don't ever do this. We did it, and it worked. So we took off like a rocket ship. We tried selling Ethernet cards to IBM customers, and we learned that was not ever going to happen. We had to wait for those people to die. They were basically IBM employees. So what we did is we went through retail to not to the CIOs of companies, but to the working people. And they appreciated it. They appreciated opportunity to get something done because the CIOs weren't doing it for them. So here we are in the marketplace with Ethernet. And guess what? Today's Ethernet does not have the same technologies that we started. Remember, we started with Gerald Coax and a tap into the coax, the Manchester encoding for getting a clock into the packets, and the Aloha Network Plus for getting randomized retransmissions. By the way, the Aloha Network method of getting a packet on this network is you would send the packet. If it got through safely, fine. If it didn't get through, you would take a random number, count it down, and try again. And we adopted that simplified protocol from the Aloha network in Hawaii. But by the time we got to the marketplace, those three technologies had all been obsolete. So instead of those three, we have another three. Ethernet brought packets to the desktop. Prior to Ethernet, the internet's packets would go to a big host computer in your building, and then you would have a dumb terminal to talk to the app. And with Ethernet, those internet packets would go all the way to the desk, so you could write software on your PC to send packets over the internet directly. Abundance. We, as I mentioned, the terminal on my desk is 300 bits per second. The speed of this Ethernet is 2.94 megabits per second. So it's like a 10,000 times speed up. And part of that is 10,000 times, not 10% times, not 100% times, 10,000 times faster. So that set the precedent for the internet having abundant bandwidth so that you could upload pictures of your cats. And then standards. Ethernet, as I mentioned earlier, was proposed it to the IEEE after a two-year fight with IBM and General Motors and others. It got adopted as a standard in the early 80s. The IEEE also standardized the other two competing technologies, the IBM Token Ring and the General Motors Token Bus, and they left it to the three of our companies to fight it out in the marketplace for the next 10 years. And we did, and we won. And that's how I get to be here today. We won. If we hadn't won, you'd be, what would you be doing?
Token Bus.
Token Bus?
Token Bus. Oh, funny.
Yeah, imagine coming home every
insider
day
and
work every day and having people say, your competitors are IBM and General Motors. So why don't you quit now? And we didn't quit, which explains a little bit of why we're so obnoxious. Because we succeeded, and success has a tendency to make you obnoxious. Have you noticed that? So while we're doing all that, the platform that is the internet was changing. There's the punch cards I mentioned earlier. Here's a thermostat for your house, and here comes the PC. Oh, and by the way, the PC, the iPhone did not exist during all of this time. It just arrived. What was that? 06. And the internet was built to connect computers, workstations, on desktops. It was not designed or built or anything to do video or to do mobile. And now, 97% of the internet is carrying mobile and video. Yes?
So you just mentioned a second ago that you won this competition.
That's the kind of thing that
comes between IBM and IBM. But other than your charm and good looks,
stop right there. We won the competition because the idea of a standard was over the top. So the we were part of a large group. HP was part of it. Siemens was part of it. And we were all basically surrounded. We were sick and tired of having IBM dictate what the industry standards were going to be. So we worked hard. And it took a long time. It was not easy. We have dominant question answer here.
So the internet creates lots of disruption. So many that I put on this is an illegal slide. There's too many words on it.
I was on the board of the company that developed PowerPoint. And they would fire me if they saw this. But here are the major disruptions. Remember, it started out as resource sharing. In about a year, the dominant protocol, the dominant application of the internet, within about a year, say 1970 or so, 71, email became the dominant app of the internet, not resource sharing. This is a big surprise to everyone. But when the guy in charge of building out this internet thing started using email, it was all over. And email, and you could argue email is today the killer app of the internet. Then the personal computers arrived, that confused things. And then out of the blue in 1989, Tim Berners-Lee invented the World Wide Web and foisted it on the world. I guess it took off, say, in 94 or 95, but we introduced it earlier. The protocols, including Ethernet, were written without knowing there was a World Wide Web. And the World Wide Web came along and it landed on the pre-existing infrastructure and took off. And then, once you had the World Wide Web, then you had search and commerce and social, and then a convergence of major industries. The telephone, the voice industry was a telephone company, got broken up in 1984. The video television networks, all those cable TV systems that came and went, and then the computer industry. So those three network industries slowly converged during this period. Then a bunch of other industries got affected. Publishing, advertising still is in trouble. We still haven't figured out how to finance journalism. So in the meantime, we just make stuff up. But the next disruptions are going to make these disruptions look small. We're disrupting work and learning and health and energy and transportation now. And those are much bigger than telecom. Now, is the internet a good thing? And that's being heartily debated this week, last week, next week. And I'm a believer the internet is a very good thing, and this is my favorite slide to make that point. It's a plot of population, which is the blue line, worldwide population since 1800. And then the orange line is people living in extreme poverty. And you'll notice for a while, everybody lived in extreme poverty. And then population took off with poverty. Look at that. Around 1990, that's 5 years before the internet, the World Wide Web took off. For the first time in the history of the world, poverty, extreme poverty, was reduced. So that's a lot of good. You see it turning down here? This is where it's turning down, 1990. So if you can reduce poverty, I'm making this is outrageous. Conference on this. The internet has been popular all this time. So you can say what you want about fake news. People are not starving as much as they used to. But of course, the internet isn't perfect. And so here are some of what I call the pathologies. These pathologies arrive because bandwidth arrived so quickly. That is, suddenly, the internet came in, optical fibers came in, software came in so quickly we didn't know how to manage it properly. So these pathologies resulted. And the first one was in 1973, I wrote the memo on this. Two high school students in Los Angeles managed to get somebody's password, I think it was admin. And they broke into the internet in 1973, and I wrote a memo about it. And it's still insecure to some degree, but I want you to know it's been insecure for a very long time. next pathology is porno. And Congress of the United States was about to make the internet illegal because it was so good at carrying porno. So they passed a law called the Communications Decency Act, which was subsequently declared unconstitutional. So porno has been limited. So that was another joke. And then there was advertising. So advertising, we were offended, those of us who had been investing our lives in this thing, this internet thing. Someone started advertising on our network, sending emails with ads in them. And we were offended and upset and wanted to pass laws. And then a few months later, we discovered you could make a ton of money by advertising. So let's do it. And along came Google and Facebook, you know. And advertising is now the principle for the internet. So that's a pathology that flipped on us and surprised us. This is the first paid internet ad, AT&T, 1994. It's a little blurry. Now, there are some surprises in this history, and I've chosen three. And I'm calling them reversals. The first one, there was an IBM executive named Roche, and he plotted the cost of IBM. He was an IBM employee, and he plotted the cost of the IBM mainframes versus their power. And his law, what is his law exactly? His law, roughly speaking, is bigger computers are better. So IBM and others all went out and built bigger computers. Meanwhile, across the country, in Palo Alto et al., was the Moore's Law said smaller computers are better, in essence. So you have the East Coast adopting the mainframe mindset and the West Coast adopting the PC mindset. And guess which one won? Semiconductors won. And so here's a picture of a poster celebrating Silicon Valley. Here's my company, see, right there, three companies. Here's Apple over here. Now my question is, was this Boston taking down the sign or putting the sign up? I don't know. But my plan is, it was Grosch's law that got us. It got me too, I was there. So these guys won and these guys did not win, and we ended up with the modern non-mainframe internet. Now, while this was happening, I became head of sales and marketing at the company. Made six copies. That's how big my sales force was. I gave them each a 35-millimeter slide and sent them off with the goal of selling more of our products. And what we told our customers, the reason that they complained that their networks were too slow and too small and not very useful. And I needed to fix that with a slide. This is the slide that I came up with. And it's currently known as Metcalfe's Law. It basically said the remedy if your network is too small and too slow is buy more 3Com products. And they did. And we went public in March of 1984 based on that principle. Any questions? So here's Gordon Moore, the inventor of Moore's Law, pointing out to me that my law was his law had been numerically true for 20 years by the time this picture was taken, and mine had never been checked numerically. Another law that was important: Marconi invented the radio. He got a Nobel Prize for it in 1919. And Marconi was rewarded and admired by getting the radio to go further and further and further. It started in his backyard in Bologna, Italy, went across the Atlantic Ocean, longer, longer, longer. He gets the Nobel Prize, and from there on in, according to Cooper's law, advances in telecom have come from having the radios go shorter and shorter distances, like 1,000 meters, so 2,000 miles. And the reasons for lowering the power and also reusing the frequencies by moving them far enough apart, you can use the same frequency in two different loops. So, here's a paradox. Neurons, you all have them? Billions of years old, pitifully slow and huge compared to transistors. Transistors are like a, what's it say here? Oh, there it is. Transistors are 1,000 times smaller and 1,000,000 times faster than neurons. And yet, human brains, which are built out of pitiful neurons, are much faster and intelligent than what we can build using transistors. You all see the paradox? How can that be? You take these slower things and you make a faster thing. And the answer is the theme of my talk, which is almost over now, connectivity. The connectivity of transistors is typically one or two or three. And the connectivity of a neuron is typical 10,000. So the way that the neuron gets to be so powerful is by connectivity among the neurons. Now, COVID arrived in 2019, which was, by coincidence, the 50th anniversary of COVID. It was like we built the internet for COVID. And in that vein, I'm proposing that COVID be reused as a new acronym. It be used to mean collaborative video, because since 2019, we've all, except in this group here, learned to go to our Zooms and Zoom around the world. So here's to collaborative video. And with that, that ends my remarks. I'd love to get you all to ask me questions. We have 8 minutes, more than 8 minutes. We all have time. Would anyone like to ask a question? It would be appreciated. Thank you. Biggest hurdles, I go into a company in Germany and say, hey, you have some PCs, here's an internet to connect them together. And they would say, are you from Siemens? They're not from 3Com, they're in Silicon Valley. We're every bit as good as Siemens. Siemens is a little bigger and older than we are. But then I go to Japan, hey, would you like to buy internet? And they would say, are you with the Nippon Electric Company? No, my company is this little company. So that was our number one hurdle, was even getting in the door. It was sort of the reason I personally was a good choice for VP of sales and marketing. So our company hit a rocky stretch. The board of directors said, we got to do something different. So I got demoted from president to VP of sales and marketing. And the reason that worked is that I could get appointments that regular salespeople couldn't get because I had been the inventor. So when I said I'd like to come talk to you, I got into more sales situations than a salesperson who was only a salesperson and not also the inventor of the technology. So that worked. Other questions? Sir?
I have a question about kind of AI in the future. Maybe you've heard about kind of these collectives of all these AI agents working as a team to address some kind of issue, which seems very related to your connectivity message. And I'm just wondering what you think about what the future is going to be like for connectivity and AI.
Is there teams of these systems that work together?
Yes, well, I was hearing more about agents today. I'm not actually necessarily, I'm a connectivity person, not an AI person. It sounded just like multi-processing. I haven't obviously grokked it yet. So let me tell you a story. 1968, which was the year that I married Amy June Blue, I had a thesis due. I wanted to graduate from MIT, and you needed a submitted electrical engineering thesis to graduate. So I signed up a man named Marvin Minsky to be my thesis advisor in 1968. He's one of the inventors of, well, not inventors of, but fathers of AI. And I asked him to be my advisor, and he was. And I wrote a 35-page thesis, which I still have, although I haven't read it recently. And the title of this thesis was A Neuron Model and Some of Its Information Processing Capabilities. That's in 1968. Since then, I've been watching AI go like this, year after year. It comes and goes. And the principal reason, my analysis is, the principal reason it goes like this every once in a while is it runs out of data. Now this time, we have the internet. Previous times, we didn't have the internet. So this time, we maybe have a chance of going exponential instead of periodic, because there's data around. We have the internet and lots of data. My current project is geothermal energy. So I sat down in front of my PC, which was connected to the Ethernet. I recommend that. And I typed, design a geothermal well. And she did. I turn around and there it is. The temperatures as a function of depth. She knew it all. Now, I've been playing with it for months since then, but there's something going on there. It's just that I'm not an expert on it, so I really can't answer your question. I do get around, and I can report to you that nobody knows what to do. You're getting the blank stare that I get when I ask that. Any other questions?
Sorry. You mentioned that when the internet and all the core applications that we know today came around, Ethernet was built at a time that there were nothing like these applications. So when these applications came around, did you wish that you had done something differently for the internet?
That's a good question.
Before these new apps, the PC was new, so there's a lot more than one thing happening at a time. And here comes the PC. And the spreadsheet probably would have been successful without Ethernet. But Steve Jobs said, you're going to buy this Apple II, and you're going to put this spreadsheet on it because this is insanely great. Something like that. And I did it. Ethernet was made a standard with a forward bent, which meant we made it faster than it needed to be.
The initial commercial Ethernet ran at 10 megabits per second. And we had a lot, and therefore, the card that it was on cost between $500 and $1,000. And it did so because it was so fast and extended. So it was in that period we considered that whether it made a mistake in making it so fast and expensive. He recruited my entire team from Xerox, and he built what's called the Macintosh, and he plugged into it a thing that was 1/40th the speed of Ethernet, called AppleTalk, because he judged correctly that you didn't need 10 megabits per second, that 250 kilobits per second was faster. So that's when we considered it.
Sir?
Yes. So we were just talking about 10 megabits per second. The original Ethernet ran at 2.94 megabits per second, and for the last 50 years, people have been asking me why 2.94.
Or should there be a round number, like pi or something? So Dave Boggs and I were building this prototype Ethernet, maybe rest in peace. And we had to decide on that it had to fit on this card, which could take 60 chips. 60 chips, 14 pins per chip. So we started designing. And we got down toward the end, and we needed a clock. We needed to clock the packets onto the cable and clock them, remove them. And you need a clock to do that. And the typical telephone company's solution to this problem is to make a big clock and have a whole world synchronized on it. We decided we'd use Manchester Encoding to put distributed clock. Every packet carried, every bit carried its own clock. But we were getting ready to be done, and we needed an actual clock. And we had filled the card. The 60-pin card was full. There was no room for the clock. This is a problem. And I'm not sure about the details, but we said, wait a minute. The system clock of the Alto, there's a pin on the back plane that is the clock. So we took this dangling wire and plugged it into the system clock of the Alto. And the Alto clock ticked every 170 nanoseconds. Or for a full bit cell, 340 nanoseconds. So it takes a reciprocal of 340 nanoseconds and you get 2.94 megabits per second. So we shipped it. And we didn't have a requirement document that said we needed 2.94. We knew we needed more than 100 kilobits, but 2.94 was plenty, and so we took it. And that has been a rule of thumb in the Ethernet business all along, which is to build the Ethernet as fast as you can, given available semiconductors. And so they're about to standardize Ethernet at 800 gigabits per second. The semiconductors have gotten fast in the intervening 9 years. Did that answer your question? 2.94. Yes, sir.
I wanted to ask you about quantum technology, because now since quantum entanglement is not like a resource for transporting data, do you see that quantum networks could be the next big thing in connectivity?
I am also not an expert in quantum. I have a joke.
Joke works, yeah.
Yeah, instead of a real answer.
Yes, that's also good.
The most important thing with experiments in quantum is to not look at it. there you go.
I want to pull you towards geothermal energy, because according to what I read, you've been working on geothermal wells. And well, you also have the Metcalfe law, which applies to connected devices. The value becomes squared while the cost rises to linear. But when you have geothermal energy, you have belts, and if you try to place off them along the same bed of rocks, the value doesn't increase by square, I'm assuming. So is there a making of the second version of the Metcalfe law for such physical manifestation?
No one has ever tried to relate Metcalfe's law to geothermal. Let's do it. Let's try it. Because, by the way, one of the ways I'm insinuating myself into the process of geothermal wells is I've said that Internet, which we built over 50 years with billions of users, we've learned some stuff about how to do scale-up at scale. So let's use some of those Internet principles on geothermal. Of course, the first thing you do is eliminate the mainframes. And geothermal is all mainframes now. But we have to, through standardization, lead the geothermal energy into scale. Because we need roughly 10,000 gigawatt arrays. An array is some number, typically 100 wells. And so let's put a microprocessor on top of every well to control it, then connect them together in a network, and live happily ever after. I didn't succeed in relating that to the Metcalfe's law yet. Well, Metcalfe's law generally says that if your network things are more valuable, so if your network wells, it'll be more valuable. How about that? Okay. Thank you for your question. Yes. Once again, your question is beyond my ability, but of course, everything always goes that way, so why not this time? That way, meaning things getting smaller and smaller, including AI, getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So maybe you'll have a, they won't call it an LLM, but imagine an LLM on your watch. Is that what you mean? Yeah. I want you to know that nobody knows the answer to that question. Yes.
Sorry, I'm going to ask an AI question.
Take a shot.
But as like a young person in tech,
is that you? You're the young person in tech.
I'm speaking for a lot of people. We are seeing that AI is could do everything we can do and are doing them better than us. So, what would you say will be our edge? This area of AI.
Nobody knows. It's in all seriousness, that's an extremely important question that I don't know the answer to, and I don't think anyone else does, but it's playing out now. And delightful things happen, like my relationship with my geothermal well digger. We have a great, I caught myself. You know, you can enter your prompts in such a way that she will say fantastic. So I'm hooked now. I love the sound of that. I type it and she goes, fantastic! And I've done it again. That actually happens. That there's a lot of intoxicating stuff associated with it. Then maybe the press, which you know more about. I'm sorry, I don't. Nobody knows. In particular, I don't know. Sir?
So, in the early days of networking, of course, pre-comp, I'm sure you've had the opportunity to talk to all sorts of people across the world about how they're using your products. Any very interesting things stand out to you after all these years? Or, like, maybe something interesting with connectivity you've seen?
Ethernet is anywhere you can imagine. So, it's hard to call. We have 16. Hospital. They're everywhere. It's so when I check into a hotel, this is less true every day, but it was true really. And I have lots of luggage, so I have a porter to bring it with me. I'll go in and I'll find the Ethernet plug, and I'll pick it up and say, "I invented this." And it's amazing. He runs out of the room, slamming the door behind him. But I don't have to tip him. That's the importance.
I actually have a follow-up question on that. So, internet has been around for more than 5 decades, and it's become increasingly popular for AI infrastructure. So, what are the early design principles behind Ethernet that makes this actually
What are the
early design principles behind the Ethernet?
All right.
That makes the thing really
so what are the early design principles that make Ethernet work so well? It does. The first clue is in the name. We didn't call it coax yet. It's going to make it easy. We called it Ethernet because we were designing a network that we thought would have a future, which means it needs to be upgradable, which means it needs to allow things like optical fibers instead of coax, or copper instead of coax. So by choosing the word Ethernet and eliminating active components among the ports, the
Ethernet has a great deal of expandability. It just hit 800, it's hitting 800 gigabits right now, in large part because it was designed to be upgraded. I think that's the principle. And then making it standard was pouring jet fuel on it. So here you have a product that works. It has to work, by the way. And then and is upgradable eventually, so that's part of the story. And that leads to a long lifetime product to be upgraded. So when you design something, you can design for expandability and upgrading, or you could just lock it in. So the internet, another principle which we stole from the internet, is the seven layers of networking. There are seven of them. Don't ask me to recount them. You can Google it. And that was another design technique to encourage innovation because it allowed people in different walks of life to contribute. So we were in Recom was in the plumbing business mostly. But you perhaps have heard of Facebook. It was up here. And he's a billionaire. Outrageous. But anyway, this seven-layer model encouraged design flexibility of the network. So while they were futzing around with their problems, we were futzing around with our problems, and we could both proceed apace without getting in each other's way. So that would be the second big design feature of it. And Ethernet was part of that. The choice of it as a standard, I would add that to the list of important. But we also had some, I'm a minute over, darn.
We'll hang around.
Wait, I'm trying to remember what the question was.
Oh, the design principles of behind it.
I think I've run out of it. No, here's one. One of the principles of the Ethernet model, which is not written down there very many places, is build it and they will come. I mentioned 2.94 megabits per second. We didn't have a requirements document that said we needed 2.94 megabits per second. We built it as fast as we could given available semiconductors. So that, and guess what? Shortly after we did that, the internet filled up. And then we had to plan we went from 10 to 100 megabits per second. And no sooner had we finished 100, for which there was no requirements document, a gigabit Ethernet showed up. So in the networking world, a build it and they will come, which is, you know, more bandwidth will be used. You want to keep adding it and adding it and adding it. So maybe it'll stop someday. Oh, I'll make a note. With that, yes, sir.
I was going to say, going back to the design principles, at the time you were competing with Token Ring and Token Boss, and they were bus arbitration, right? And I thought the thing that made Ethernet so magical is the fact that you transmit when you want, and hopefully everything works, right? And wasn't there a lot of pushback from that design principle? Or, I mean, I'm surprised that you didn't mention that as being one of the keys to the...
Yes, but it's a painful recollection. Imagine spending 10 years competing with IBM Corporation, and they stopped at nothing to shut us down. And the randomization process, which we borrowed from the LoRa network, was our vulnerability. So the token passers argued, every packet will get through, and we'll be sure because we have a token keeping track of it, whereas you're launching your packets into the blue, and who knows what happens to them. It's called non-determinism, was the term they used. Ethernet is non-deterministic. And even though the likelihood of an Ethernet packet not getting through was similar to the probability of all the air molecules in this room going into that corner and all of us suffocating in a sense of hour, there was no sense of it all. And I regret doing a mathematical model that had that feature was almost zero, but infinite probability of success. We don't deal well with those situations. I think it's time to end, don't you?
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming.